I hereby certify that the above described wire cage was this day altered by removing the bottom sheet, and extending the sides continuously down to the floor, making the whole height 0 ft. The cage from floor to crown 7 feet 9 inches. In my opinion, it is impossible to introduce a hand or head within the said cage without taking it apart. The two edges of the wire cloth sheets are now permanently attached to the inner front face of the cabinet by staples driven home, and tie wires passing clear through the boards and tied on the outer face 0 ft. The same. James P. Fenth, Wire Worker, 36 North 6th Street, Phil. The cut affords a very good idea of the form, dimensions, and penetrability of the cage. We held a seance at 5 p.m., but it was very unsatisfactory to me, as, relying upon the cage, I put neither Mrs. Holmes nor her husband in the bag, and both were inside the cabinet at the same time. I fancied I heard them working at my wire cage as if trying to effect an opening, but they did not succeed, and beyond the drawing of the curtain aside, nothing occurred at that aperture. At the other, John King showed himself, and also a female face, purporting to be Katie's, but not satisfactorily identified. At the evening seance, a hand and arm appeared within the basket, and swept across the window and back. John King's head also appeared there, rising from below and dropping again. It was not satisfactory, however, for I could not understand why, if it were genuine, it might not stay as long and show itself as freely there as at the other window. I had a very clever juggler with me this evening, one who is famous as a maker of mechanical tricks for jugglers. He was introduced to me by Mr. Coleman Sellers, the distinguished engineer, president of the Franklin Institute, and the correspondent mentioned by Mr. Crooks, in one of his pamphlets, as an ingrained skeptic. Mr. Harding, the amateur juggler, thought, upon examining the wire cage after the seance, that there was one spot sufficiently unconfined by the staples to permit of squeezing a hand through and manipulating a mask, so the next day I had this attended to. At the seance in question, two faces were shown at the right aperture, John King's and another. The former looked natural, and by drawing the curtain aside and peering in, I saw, at one and the same time, John's head high up to the left, behind the door, and Mr. Holmes sitting in the chair before me. John's head was, therefore, not a mask worn by Holmes. On the 21st, I had a long consultation with another juggler of acknowledged skill and also a dealer in juggler's apparatus, Mr. Yost by name, who explained to me the manner in which he fancied that Mrs. Holmes got her hands out of the bag, to work artificial faces. It is to make a slight rip or cut in the hem covering the drawstring, and then draw enough slack string through inside to enable her to slip out either her hands, or her whole bust if she chooses. This plan requires that she shall have one hand free while the bag is being sealed, so that she can pull on the slack, and make me believe I am sealing up the mouth effectually and tightly. The explanation did not seem satisfactory, but I determined that no such trick should be played upon me from that time forward. At any rate, we held a test seance at 4 o'clock that day, at which, among others, Mr. Rowan and General Lippert were present. At my last interview with John King, at me, W.S. Rooms, I requested him to give me a private sign when I should next see him at Holmes, and he consented. He came to the aperture at this afternoon seance, and looking at me, he gave the sign by turning his head from left to right and back again twice in succession. He also gave to me, W.B., a certain sign known only to themselves. A detached hand was shown inside the cage, and then we tried a very interesting test, premising by saying that Mr. Holmes, like his wife, is unacquainted with any foreign language. I fancy the reader will share my surprise when I state that at the request of Mr. Rowan, Dr. Felger, me, W.B., Mr. B. Tainley and myself, expressed in Italian, German, Latin, Russian, Greek, Georgian, Turkish, French and Spanish, this hand within the wire cage gave signal after signal, as many times in each instance as we severally indicated in these various languages. The hand purported to be that of John King, and hence I said in another place that he seemed to understand every language, a second Maglia Becci. We were as much astonished as Apollonius himself was in India, where, he tells us, the sages have the magical power of understanding and speaking the languages of those who come to them from the most distant countries. John also addressing me in English, said he would look after one of my sons, whose name is an unusual one, and one that certainly no person in the room had heard me mention. Mr. Rowan, General Lippitt and I very carefully scrutinized John's face as it appeared at the right window. It seemed perfectly natural, the eyes were thoroughly materialized, and were rolled about in every direction, by request. 27 persons were present that evening at the public sales. I attended to the bag with unusual care, making Mrs. Holmes keep her hands by her side constantly, holding the mouth of the bag in such a way that there could be no slack, bending her sleeves down further than usual, examining and testing the string in every way after that, and then calling up every person in the room by turns to see if it were possible for the captive medium to get a hand out to play tricks. I then closed the door, which as usual was bolted on the inside by somebody whose hands were not sealed up in a bag, and before I could turn down the gas, in the chandelier over my head, a detached hand was thrust out of the right aperture. John showed himself, and I had a long conversation with him in French, he replying correctly by movements of his head. Among other things, I asked him if it was his own voice that had spoken to me in English that afternoon about my son, and he answered affirmatively. He allowed a number to approach, and gallantly kissed his hand to several of the ladies. I saw the movement of his lips, and the sound of the osculation was so audible that all in the room could hear it. It was no mask. There was a rattling and scraping on the wire cage, as though something hard were being drawn over the meshes, but nothing happened inside, except that the curtain was drawn aside. Another face beside John's appeared, but it was not recognized. A number of hands were also shown, of different sizes, among them, one fair, well-formed, plump hand of a woman, so peculiar in its shape that I examined Mrs. Holmes' hands after the séance, only to again observe the thin, long thumb, and peculiar sickle-shaped curve of the outer edge of the palm. The London Spiritualist, of February 1, 1873, contains a bit of prima facie evidence in favor of Katie King's having actually appeared through the mediumship of the Holmeses. It is a report of a séance at Mrs. MacDougall Gregory's, 21 Green Street, Grosvenor Square, London, and the paper editorially certifies to the fact that Katie King showed herself, and two old gentlemen, one with a white beard, and one old lady. In a previous number of the same paper, Mr. J.C. Luxmore avers that he saw at Mr. Holmes' rooms, at 1111 Old Quebec Street, the identical Katie King whom he had seen three times before at Hackney in the presence of Florence Cook. Finally, in the paper called The Medium and Daybreak, a correspondent reports, in a card dated March 24, 1873, that he attended a Holmes séance at which many spirit faces were shown, among them that of the elder Katie King, who spoke in her usual whispers, and was very palpable and distinct. I had now been so long in Philadelphia without seeing the full form of Katie King that, despairing of her appearance, and having accomplished the main object of my experiments to test the materializing powers of the mediums, I was growing impatient to depart. At an afternoon test séance, both mediums sat outside at my request for a time. There were rappings inside the cabinet, and some scrapings upon the wire cage, but the experiment was a failure, and as no faces appeared, I sent Mr. Holmes inside, and sealed him up in a new bag I had made, and pinned his sleeves to it. In 5 seconds a hand was shown at the right window, then two hands were shown together, and then John King appeared, showing me his full head and shoulders. At the evening séance, the usual precautions were taken, and as usual hands were shown and John appeared and spoke to me. A woman's hand and arm were thrust quite out of the window, and after an intermission of a few minutes there came a face which struck me as soon as I saw it as the Katie King of the Holmes photograph. If it was not the identical face, it at any rate seemed to be, and this impression was made upon the mind of General Lippitt, also. I scrutinized it very closely. The face was not smooth and well-rounded, but seemingly roughly finished. The eyebrows were straight and black, the contour of face oval, rather long and thin, the dark hair lay smooth upon the brow. A gauzy white material, wrapped around it, framed the head, and made it look unnatural and ghastly. Our test seance began at 4 p.m. the next day. John, and the Katie like the photograph appeared several times. The latter borrowed General Lippitt's pocket knife, and cut off and handed him a lock of her hair, which, upon subsequent comparison with locks in the possession of Mr. Rowan and Dr. Felger, was found to be identical in texture and color, the latter a peculiar glorious shade of golden brown. While looking at this head, I saw something inside the cabinet that I would like to have someone more capable than myself explain. I saw the Katie King head, with the mouth of a bag drawn tightly about her neck as the bag was drawn about the mediums, and a hand, which was attached to an arm that came from another direction, took hold of and fondled mine. Now, one thing is perfectly clear: this hand and arm did not belong to Mrs. Holmes' body, for the seal on the bag's mouth was found unbroken after the seance. And again, if Mrs. Holmes had managed to get her hand and arm out, what bag was that which I saw drawn tightly about the neck of the Katie King there? For the bag could not be both closed and open at once. I leave the Philadelphia editors to display their preternatural shrewdness in explaining this riddle. I will help them so far as to say that the bag had no false lining nor slack string. There was no duplicate bag in the cabinet. No Confederate could either have been in there before the seance or got in at any time while it was progressing, and I have not exaggerated or falsified the fact. On the evening of the 24th, I had the circle at my own lodgings, a different suite of rooms from that in which the former seance was held. A cabinet was improvised in the same manner as before, the black muslin curtain with apertures, hanging over the front door, and the other door being sealed by General Lippitt to prevent the admission of any person or thing from behind. 9 persons were present, including the 2 mediums. Mrs. Holmes was put into the bag, and Mr. Holmes sat outside the cabinet with us. I completed the sealing of the string, and then began to drive in a few tacks to bolt the curtain to its place, but before I could drive the second tack, a detached hand was thrust into view from the upper aperture, quite a distance above the medium's head. John King showed himself very distinctly, and calling up Mr. Beatainerly communicated to him, in his own language, the Georgian, a secret that he supposed none knew except himself. He kissed his hand several times, by request, and also saluted the cheek of a lady, who offered it for the purpose. I stood at the aperture and talked much with him, he addressing me in a voice audible to all, and I not a foot distant from his face. Katie, or what purported to be she, also showed herself, but badly materialized, her eyes being not more than half formed. With her permission, I thrust my arm through to feel the medium, and Katie, whom I saw at my right as a dim, indistinct shape, guided my hand to the place by taking me by the coat sleeve. This was necessary, as the aperture was so high that I had to stand upon tiptoe to get my arm through, and could not look in Mrs. Holmes' direction while my arm was inside. I repeated this experiment to make assurance doubly sure, and this time carefully felt the medium's head, neck, shoulders, and passed my hand down her arm, which was unmistakably inside the bag, the spirit hand clutching my sleeve the whole time. Mrs. Holmes' eyes were tightly closed, her face was deathly cold, and her forehead covered with a clammy dew. General Lippitt was permitted to do the same thing, and has published an account of the seance in the Banner of Light, of date February 6, 1875. General L. noticed in Katie's accent this evening certain dialectic peculiarities which were associated in his memory with the Katie he had seen last May in the Holmes seances. After this satisfactory experiment, I requested Mr. and Mrs. Holmes to favor us with a dark seance, and, this being agreed to, the 9 persons in the company drew their chairs together and joined hands, Mr. and Mrs. Holmes being separated from each other. Under these circumstances, we were all touched by invisible hands, myself often and in various places. Sometimes 3 or 4 of us were touched simultaneously, a pair of hands were laid upon my head, a bunch of plumes was swept across our faces, and then a cloth of some light fabric, and, Finally, at me, Debbie's order, some beautiful lights danced in the air over her head and then disappeared. These phenomena were similar to what had occurred almost every evening in Mrs. Holmes' dark circles, but in this instance there was absolutely no possibility of trickery, and this account will suffice for all. The next evening my last test séance was held, and it was a very notable one. While my experiments had demonstrated beyond doubt the fact that many phenomena occur in the presence of the Holmeses, which are not due to trickery, yet I had seen neither Katie King nor any other spirit, in full form, and I was not entirely satisfied with the results of my labors. It was here that me, Debbie, brought her wonderful power to the test. Summoning John King, she intimated her will that Katie should step out of the cabinet that evening, and he wrote her with his own hand a message to the effect that her orders should be obeyed. This communication is in my possession, and General Lippitt has seen it. A select company of 6 persons, besides the 2 mediums, met at Mr. Holmes' residence at 8 o'clock, and after taking the usual precautions against fraud, including a strange exercise of me, W.S. power, which threw Mrs. Holmes into a death-like trance, and so made her perfectly incapable of resorting to trickery. The light was dimmed, and we sat in silence waiting for the working of the mystic spell. Phenomenal disturbances soon began. Raps were heard all over the cabinet, various voices addressed us from within its recesses, and a detached hand, coming out of the right aperture, and gliding down the face of the cabinet, clutched a small handbell that stood upon a table, and, ringing it all the while, rose again to the aperture and disappeared with it, within. This last manifestation was calculated to startle one out of all his preconceived notions of both anatomy and gravity, and it really gave to the séance a most uncanny aspect. But the crowning test was to come. We heard the bolt drawn inside, and in breathless silence watched the cabinet door swing slowly open. I sat within a few feet of the entrance, and plainly saw at the threshold a short, thin, girlish figure, clad in white from crown to sole. She stood there motionless for an instant, and then slowly stepped forward a pace or two. By the obscure light we could see that she was shorter and much more delicately built than the medium, and her dress with its trailing skirt, and the long veil that completely enveloped her form, were as crisp as though just from the hands of the modist. Who she was or what she was, I do not know, but one thing I do know, she was not Jenny Holmes, nor any puppet or confederate of hers. And I know, further, that me, Debbie, who sat next to me, uttered one word in a strange tongue, and the spectre immediately withdrew as noiselessly as she had entered. When the meeting broke up we found Mrs. Holmes in her bag, with its unbroken seals, and in so deep a catalepsy as to alarm Dr. Felger at first. It was some minutes before she had either respiration or a pulse, and as she is recovering I leave her in the case with these conclusions. R. While it may be possible that either Eliza White or somebody else assisted the Holmeses to deceive the public, by personating Katie King, the evidence hitherto attainable does not enable us to designate any one of the phenomena observed and described by Mr. Rowan or General Lippitt as probably fraudulent. The accuser of the Holmeses is apparently successfully impeached, and her endorser, Dr. Child, shown to be incompetent to testify. The decision of the moot question being, therefore, of necessity made to depend upon the issue of my own course of experiments, A. The real mediumship of both Nelson and Jenny Holmes, and especially the appearance of materialized spirit forms through the same, seem to be demonstrated. 3. The Philadelphia experiments have a most important bearing upon those of Mr. Crookes, in London, and of myself, at Chittenden, V.T., and Havana, N. Why? 4. The very grave question whether the visits and behavior of spirits are within human control, is forced upon our attention. Its examination, moreover, involves the verification or rejection, by modern scientific processes, of the biblical, historical, and traditional accounts of intercourse between man and the angel world, the definition of the laws of so-called magic and sorcery, the formulae of evocation and exorcism, and the moral effects of this intercourse upon humanity. We cannot afford that another day shall be lost. The hour is come. Let the man step to the front. 478, the Compton Transfiguration. I do not know of any author who has defined the position which the student of science occupies in our day better than Professor Huxley himself. In a recent essay, he says, "The only opinion he, the votary of science, need care about, if he care for any, and he is all the wiser and better if he care for none, is that of about a dozen men, two or three in these islands, Great Britain, as many in America, and half a dozen on the continent. If these think well of his work, his reputation is secure from all the attacks of all the able editors of all the influential organs put together." With such encouraging words as these before me, I shall proceed to tell the story of my remarkable experience at Havana, N.Y., hoping at least to deserve the good opinion of their author, and the dozen colleagues whom he had in mind while penning the sentences above quoted. If Mr. Huxley is not now willing to follow the theory of evolution to its legitimate conclusions, and discover to us man as he exists in the spirit world, there is satisfaction in knowing that the time is not far distant when he will be compelled, by the accumulation of phenomena similar to those hereinafter described, to acknowledge that his immortality is a demonstrable scientific problem. At one of my last interviews with the alleged spirit John King, in Philadelphia, he told me that if I would go to the village of Havana, Schuyler County, New York, I would see a phase of manifestation entirely new to this country, and the precursor of a whole series of unprecedented interest and importance. In short, he gave me to understand that we were about to witness the advent of the psychological mysteries which, for many ages, have been confined to the temples and pagodas of Egypt and Hindostan. Acting upon this information, I found myself in the village designated, on the evening of the 29th of January, of the present year, 1875. The medium I sought was a poor woman, named Elizabeth J. Compton, living with a second husband, and the mother of nine children, of whom five girls and one boy are alive. Her maiden name was Henning, and she was born August 16, 1829. On September 3, 1848, she was married to George W. Soles, in the town of Barrington, Yates County, N.Y. Her husband, Soles, was for many years an invalid, and she supported the whole family by the hard labor of washing. Her rounded shoulders, angular frame, horny palm, and the fingers bent out of shape by constant immersion in the hot suds of the wash tub, abundantly corroborate the story of her faithful exertions and honest toil. 480, coming of laboring people, marrying in her own class, and having the cares of a large family so soon thrust upon her, she had no time to obtain an education, and she can neither read nor write. Like the Eds, she inherits mediumship, her paternal grandmother and an aunt having been known as witches, and reported to possess the evil eye. Her maternal grandmother, an Indian squaw, was brought up among the whites, but was not unfamiliar with the rude sorceries that prevailed among her people. Like the case of the Eds, also, the medianic power descends to her children. I sat at a table alone with the youngest, a pretty little girl of 5 years, and with my hand laid upon her tiny little hands, the rappings occurred all over the table. This child is also said to be clairvoyant, as well as several of her sisters. Mrs. Compton first saw a spirit when a child of 9 years, and after that her lucidity was frequently demonstrated. The exceedingly limited space at my command forbids mention of many instances, related to me by herself, of visions, prophetic warnings, and encounters with spiritual beings that occurred in her experience. Suffice it to say that they were of a character similar to those which have been fully described in this book in connection with the psychological history of the members of the Eddy family. Her mediumship for physical phenomena dates from March 1873, when a neighbor, calling in one evening, proposed that they should form a circle in the chamber where Mr. Soles was lying sick. She was so little familiar with spiritualism that she supposed the circle meant was the praying circle of the Methodists, and readily consented. A table was drawn up near the bed, and, taking their places at it, she says she was astonished to hear rappings under their hands, and still more so when a communication was spelled out, purporting to come from a young man named Melville Barton, who had been murdered a day or two before, and for whose body search was then being made. The spirit described the murder, and indicated where his body would be found, which information the next day proved to be true. Sittings of a similar character were held frequently after this, and the rappings grew louder and louder. Mr. Soles finally died, and then he, too, began to manifest his presence in the spirit. One night a slate belonging to Mr. Soles was lying upon a projecting timber in the room, and she heard the noise of the pencil moving over its surface, although no person was near it. Upon examination, it was discovered that a communication had been written upon the slate by an invisible hand, and after that this form of manifestation was repeated very frequently. On the evening of the 12th of February 1874, her present husband, Mr. Compton, being at the house, it was proposed that they should try to get materializations, and accordingly a blanket was tacked over a doorway for the experiment. Six spirit hands were shown around the edges of the blanket, and the affair becoming known, the experiment was repeated in many houses in Havana and the adjacent village of Watkins, with uniformly satisfactory results. Before long, the figure of a spirit child appeared, and then faces and busts of various persons were shown. In April, the spirits began to talk in their own voices, and flowers and other material objects were displayed. On the 6th of September, a young girl, calling herself Katie Brink, an Indian warrior of the Seneca tribe, and a squaw named Starlight stepped out of the improvised cabinet, in full form. Since the date mentioned, only six different spirits have walked out, viz., Katie Brink, the Seneca, Starlight, Katie Weaver, a Mrs. Rhodes and the Reverend Gardner Crum. No more than three have appeared upon any one evening, and usually only two Seneca and Katie Brink are seen. Such are the statements made to me by Mrs. Compton and corroborated by other persons. I repeat them without comment. The seances are now held in a second-story chamber, 15 feet square, and devoted exclusively to this purpose. Across one corner, a plastered partition has been run, forming a triangular cupboard, or closet, just large enough to admit of a person sitting in the apex of the triangle. There is no window, trap or outlet, the walls being all solid, and the floor securely fastened down, with the boards running under the mop board, except one which is badly matched, but this is nailed to the joists by a dozen nails, and cannot be pried up without breaking it into pieces. The angles of three rooms join directly underneath this cabinet, and the ceilings of all are perfectly solid. The following sketch gives an idea of the external appearance of the cabinet. It will be observed that there is no aperture in the wall, but an open space is left by sawing off the upper portion of the door. Across this opening a curtain of black muslin stretches upon a wire inside the frame. My first séance with the medium was on the evening of January 30. The spectators, numbering a half dozen, sat upon chairs in the room, about 8 feet from the cabinet. Mrs. Compton took her seat on the chair inside. The lamp in the room was turned down very low, and for a long time nothing interesting occurred. Finally the door opened and the figure of an Indian appeared on the threshold, spoke to us, greeted me cordially, but did not emerge, as he said the medium was in too weak and prostrated a condition to afford him the power requisite. The following evening, the girl Katie Brink showed herself, and walked about, touching various persons, patting their heads and cheeks. Clad in a flowing robe of crisp white muslin, her head covered with a bride veil that fell down to her knees, gliding about with velvet footsteps, speechless, and half seen in the obscurity, she reminded me of Goethe's Bride of Corinth. By the waning lamp's uncertain gleaming there he sees a youthful maiden stand, robed in white, of still and gentle seeming, on her brow a black and golden band. Passing from the other spectators, she came to me, sitting apart and with one hand laid against the cabinet wall, and first gently stroking my head, she sat upon my knee, and passing an arm over my shoulder kissed me upon my left cheek. Her weight seemed scarcely as much as that of a child of 8 years, but her arm felt solid upon my shoulder, and the lips that caressed me were as natural as life. By prearrangement, I passed into the cabinet, while the girl was outside, and found no medium there, although I not only examined every nook, but, the better to assure myself that I was not psychologized, felt the chair, the walls and all the space about.